Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 28th, 2016. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Malcolm Fraser from Brewlosophy.com joins us with an experiment. Will adding sugar to a Belgian-style beer be better if you add it all at once or in staggered additions over time into the fermenter? If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. And don't forget to get a fresh copy of our Brewer's Logbook for 2016. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks very much again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show. We greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. And thanks to everybody who's done so already. If you contribute via the support link, I'll send you an email with links to this year's bonus video showing Steve making Kansas City-style burnt ends out of a chuck roast and cooking up his personal barbecue sauce recipe to go along with that. And I plan to make that myself this week, so I'll report next week if I get a chance to do that. Let's look into the mailbag, shall we? We have more feedback about Matt from San Antonio's Christmas beer that didn't carbonate from a couple episodes back. This is from Tom. Tom says, I did some quote-unquote dry spicing split batch experiments on a 10% Imperial Stout once. Anything with even a small amount of cinnamon didn't carbonate. Interesting. Then there's this from Joe. You didn't go into the specifics of the recipe, but I'm assuming there were probably some tree bark spices in that beer. This brought to mind something I had read previously in a book called Bread by Jeffrey Hamelman. According to Hamelman, cinnamon, specifically cinnamic aldehyde, greatly impairs the yeast's activity, so a higher percentage of yeast is necessary to overcome it. Tree bark spices in general, such as mace, allspice, nutmeg, and cinnamon, all have compounds that inhibit yeast activity when used in appreciable amounts. Of course, he is referring to bread yeast, but I wonder if this could also be affecting beer yeast performance in highly spiced ales. Anyway, Joe says, I'm surely no scientist, but I thought I'd offer you a different perspective. Well, I appreciate that different perspective, Joe and Tom. You've heard me talk endlessly about my fruitcake barley wine, and that thing has cinnamon, cloves, and nutmeg in it. However, I did pitch a good amount of USO5 into the beer because it had an original gravity of 1.121 and an ABV of 12.7%. And while that beer wasn't what you'd call fizzy, I think it did have an appropriate bit of carbonation, so maybe I pitched enough yeast to do the trick, though. Very interesting stuff if you've had experience with cinnamon or other barks inhibiting yeast performance. Let me know. Eric in Indiana is, or if it worked out okay, let me know. What's your secret? Eric in Indiana is a new brewer who writes in after brewing his first two batches at 5 gallons. He wasn't impressed with those first two batches, so he switched to 3-gallon batches. And Eric says, I think smaller 3-gallon or less batches are the way to go for the new brewer. Here are my reasons for my thoughts. Number one, you can learn a lot from scaling recipes down. The local homebrew supply store can and will help. There are a lot of sources on the web, too. Number two, it's easier to drink or give away the mistakes or okay beer just over a case. Number three, as with any craft, practice is needed to improve. You get to brew more. And number four, you can learn about your equipment without the bigger price tag of 5-gallon ingredients. Eric says, my last 2 3-gallon batches are much better. I'll have a hard time sharing these, and I've learned a ton about my equipment. Plus, I'm getting ready to brew again. Well said, Eric. Another voice in support of smaller batches, at least for some applications. Then maybe once you get your confidence up, you can step up to bigger batches. I finally had a chance to brew myself this past week. I used some of my homemade crystal-style malt that I made out of Vienna. I added 6 ounces of that to 9 more pounds of Vienna to make an ale with Czech Saaz hops. And now I'm still calling this a single malt and single hop beer or a smash beer, but I put the question out there on Twitter, and there was some debate over whether that was still true because, I used 2 different flavors of the Vienna malt there. So, even though it came out of the same bag initially. I brewed the beer inside in the kitchen on my electric brewing system from our sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. This electric setup gives me the flexibility to brew inside or out because I worked with Dave to get a length of cable that will either fit, put me inside the kitchen or outside on the patio. That's something that my old propane setup did not do. I couldn't brew in the kitchen with that. And I discovered something new this time. I cranked up the boil to be a bit more vigorous than I usually do. And by the end of the 1 hour boil, the kitchen was more steamy than I've ever seen it. In fact, by the end of the boil, the kitchen windows looked like a car at a drive-in movie in the 1950s. The Blickman boil coil is powerful. Very impressive. I zipped through the brew day. And I didn't do an exact calculation, but I figure it was about 4 hours for 5 gallons. And with the electronic controller on the high gravity system, I didn't have to worry about missing my strike temperature or losing heat during my mash rest. I tell you, I'm getting spoiled. I was able to do things around the kitchen while the water was heating up to strike temperature, and I was able to go and mail some stuff at the post office when the mash was happening, and I didn't have to worry about it at all. Check out the electric brew-in-a-bag systems like mine or 3-tier systems at highgravitybrew.com. And for ingredients and many other products on highgravitybrew.com, you'll get $7.99 flat rate shipping. Check out our friends at highgravitybrew.com. Now, we've enjoyed being part of several Brewlosophy experiments from the folks at brewlosophy.com, brewlosophy.com, Ragmop. And this experiment is no exception. Malcolm Fraser poses the question this time, does it matter if you dose your sugar for a Belgian all at once in the fermenter or in staggered additions over time? Malcolm Fraser, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me, James.
We're talking about Belgian candy sugar today, right? Or is it just Belgian sugar? What are we talking about?
Well, it's not candy sugar. It's just plain old beet sugar, stuff you can buy at the grocery store.
All right. We'll take it.
All right.
So what's the premise here? What are we talking about?
So if you listen to podcasts such as yours or do a lot of blog reading or magazine reading, BYO or Zymergy, you've probably come across large gravity beers and the use of sugar. And some people will either advocate pitching it all in at once, either at the end of the boil, at the beginning of fermentation, sometimes at the beginning of the boil instead of the end of the boil, whatever you want to do. And they will say, that's fine, pitch all that sugar at once. And then some people have complained about stalled fermentations for that, not getting all the way through the fermentation, getting all your attenuation down, or perhaps increased ester production, or in a real bad case, during one of my early days, I had a pretty phenolic beer and a fusel alcohol beer. It just did not go right. I think I overstressed the yeast, didn't have enough nutrients. Who knows? I probably made a bunch of sins at once, but essentially I had a fusel alcohol bomb.
So the theory is if you put too much sugar in at once, the yeast can't handle it and they get stressed out and they cause off flavors in your beer.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it, but that's the gist of it. That's the anecdotal evidence, and some people have, you know, the experience like I did early on. So some people would advocate spreading the sugar additions out, perhaps only adding a little bit at the beginning or adding none, waiting through fermentation gets going at high Kroisen, for example, or some people have even advocated waiting for fermentation just beginning to wane, then adding sugar. There's more than one way to do it, for sure.
Mm. And back, 10 years ago or so, there was talk of the way to get a really, really, really high gravity beer was to feed your beer sugar additions, you know, staggered sugar additions throughout the fermentation process, and that allegedly got you this really high alcohol beer. So that, I guess that would be along the same lines, as the same theory.
Yes. Essentially, I think some of the high gravity brewers have said they have done as much as well. They'll go through and, you know, keep nursing the yeast along as the fermentation begins to wane. You give another dose of sugar, give another dose of sugar. So people have experienced the ability to make very, very large beers, you know, 1.2 and bigger. You probably heard some of these famous beers, breweries having these competitions about who can make the highest alcohol beer, and that was supposedly one of the techniques they used.
So when you're brewing a Belgian beer, you want the yeast to get stressed a bit, because you get some interesting quote unquote off flavors or byproducts from the yeast that makes it taste like a Belgian beer.
Certainly, if you've read the book Brew Like a Monk by Stan Hieronymus, he even talks about that. And I'm not sure if it was in that book or later interviews. I don't want to misquote him, but something along the lines of some Belgians believe that American brewers overpitch, especially when it comes to these higher gravity and supposedly very dry and digestible Belgian beers. Because if you overpitch, the theory goes that you can suppress ester production and phenol production. And what do we think of when we think of Belgian beers? They have a little bit of this pear, apple, you know, maybe a touch of banana, fruity flavor. I mean, not too much, just enough. And they also have some spices, you know, white pepper, maybe a little bit of clove, very subtle clove, if any, coriander. You know, those are all phenols. And one of the ways to coax that out is to provide a little bit of stress and a good amount of growth for your yeast.
So balance is everything.
Balance is everything. I can't say I figured that out yet.
Yeah, most homebrewers, that's the biggest challenge, because we don't want things to be balanced. We want things to be extreme and out there, or at least most homebrewers in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the things with this beer is we'll talk more about the beer later, I'm sure, but I have made triples a couple times and Belgian Golden Straws a couple times, and it's not a style I can say I've nailed yet. And I think the last time I overpitched, and I think I had too insipid of a beer. And this time I underpitched, and we'll talk about the results about that.
So let's get into the experiment. How did you go about answering this question?
Okay, so I wanted to add the sugar in a way that homebrewers would. So one of the ways they do that is some people will put it at the end of the boil. But the way our experiments are designed and the limitations of home brewing equipment, I would have had to like take half the beer away, you know, set it aside, compensated for the fact that one beer is still being heated and maybe isomerizing alpha acids. And you can just imagine the string of variables it creates. So instead, I made 11 gallons of the beer and I diverted it into two fermenters. And from there, that's where the experiment starts. And day before, I made a syrup. So I took all the sugar I was going to use, which was, you know, 4 pounds, and I dissolved it in, I think, the smallest amount of water I could. I think it was like 500 milliliters. And then made this somewhat thick syrup. And I basically did it a water bath canning method. It's not what I would do for long-term storage, but for like 2 or 3 days, I think it would be okay. Mm-hmm. So I took that and I chilled it. And one of the single dose beer got half of the amount, the total volume. I don't remember what the total volume was, because after you put sugar in 500 milliliters of water, it got like 750 or 800 milliliters, whatever it was. And I took half of that and added it to one of the beers, about 5.25 gallons is what I ended up with. So that one started at about 1.079. The other beer was not given any sugar at this time. So then they both received oxygen and they both received equal pitch of yeast.
And talk about your recipe.
So yeah, 85% Pilsner, about 0.88% aromatic, and then 14 and some change was the beet sugar. Mm. For hops, I bittered at 75 minutes with 35 grams, you know, 12% Magnum, and then Zots at 30 minutes, that was like 28 grams, and then a flame out addition of 14 grams of Zots again.
But this beer is not about hops.
No, no. I think you want a little bit of aroma and you know, a little bit of noble hop aroma, our continental noble variety. But and if you look at some of the classic recipes, they're more bitter than people realize, but not quite as bitter as perhaps a triple. But yeah, I wanted, you know, at least enough bitterness to try to balance the sweetness.
Sure. And then how did you add the yeast? Did you use a starter?
One at a time, drop by drop. Took forever.
A cell at a time. 1 billion 1, 1 billion 2.
I had an abacus, you know. Yeah, so I created a starter, and in this instance, I actually counted the yeast. So I created a 2-liter starter. I had one vial that was new and an older vial I threw in there. And then I did a count, and I got my cell density, you know, and I extrapolated from my cell density how much of the starter I needed to add to each, and it just ended up, you know, somewhere around 800 mils each. I'm not going to go into the entire counting process, but I tried to get it into the point where I was slightly underpitching when you consider it a standard ale. I think last time I overpitched and the beer was lacking the esters and lacking the phenols.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I interrupted you. At the point in the process, you pitched your yeast and half the sugar in one of the fermenters, and yeast and no sugar in the other.
That's
so
right.
When did you start adding the sugar additions in the second one?
So the remaining half of the sugar, I split into 3 equal portions. I did this by volume because now I have the remaining sugar solution, and I just, you know, it's graduated, so I knew how much to add. So after it ended up being somewhere around 28 hours, you know, I was shooting for 24, but I wanted to make sure I had a good fermentation going. So it ended up being about 28 hours. I added the first dose of sugar.
Okay.
Interestingly, within that 24 hours, the single edition beer, the beer that got all the sugar at once, it had already dropped to the OG. Had there been no sugar. So it went from about 1078, 1079, all the way down to 1060 in about 24 hours. It ate all the simple sugar. Like my little toddlers, you know. But I think that met out too in observations. Like the pH had dropped rapidly. I had this massive Croizen, about a couple, say 5-6 hours before the non-sugared beer. And I took a temperature, and it was about 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees warmer, too.
Hmm. So the yeast was happy, or at least it was a party. At least it was active.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you're active, you are stressed.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the theory, right? You don't want to go on a sugar high and then and flame out, right?
The Red Bull effect. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 28 hours, you got it was a third of the sugar?
That's right. A third of the remaining half.
Right. And when was the second edition made?
About 24 hours later.
Okay. And the third?
I guess.
24 hours later.
Yes.
How did the second fermenter with the staggered additions function? You know, how did it behave?
Well, it did take longer to reach high Croizen. It did take longer to show any activity, for sure. It never seemed to be as vigorous. In fact, they finished around the same time. I think the staggered edition beer might have had a Croizen for another half day, but I was surprised that, you know, it wasn't like the the single dose beer just went buck wild, crazy, and petered out. That wasn't what I noticed at all. But when I was taking my yeast counts along the way, now I'm not taking a pure yeast count because I'm just taking what's in suspension in the body of the beer because I wasn't going in and rousing up the cake and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the yeast in the single edition had grown about fivefold in, say, about 28 hours. And then when I was taking the yeast counts in the staggered beer, it was like 1.5-fold, then 3-fold, and then slightly surpassed it. So in the end, the yeast, total yeast in suspension in the body of the beer was just slightly larger in the staggered edition beer than it was in the beer that had all the sugar at once, but it just took longer to get there.
Huh, that's interesting. So what conclusion do we draw from that? What assumption do we make?
Well, that's the thing, is you can sit there and say, well, that should do this and that should do this and this is how it should taste. And that's the thing with the science and the measurements and the charts and the graphs when you compare it to taste, you know, the organoleptic ability to sense that. And we might even be able to measure it, right, in the lab, but does it matter? Does it matter in taste, right?
Right, right.
We don't taste with instruments. We don't sit down in the bar with our friends and say, hey, hold on a second, let me get my gas chromatograph out here and see if I really enjoy this thing.
It reminds me, I had a friend in high school who was an audiophile, and he was replacing his stereo equipment with new stereo equipment. And I said, now, is this going to sound better? And he said, he started giving me all the stats, the specifications on the speakers and all this stuff. And I said, but is it going to sound any better? You know, how much more money are you spending on this? And can you really tell a difference?
Yeah.
But, you know, without putting a waveform scope on there or whatever. So that's where the rubber meets the road. So what about the final gravity? Where did they come out on the final gravity?
So knowing what you know about beer, what would you think would end up drier?
My assumption is that since there was more yeast and since it was less stressed, apparently, that the staggered edition would come out drier because the yeast would be in better shape to handle all that sugar. That's my assumption.
Right, and that's one of the objectives of doing this, right, is to get a drier beer. Now, mind you, this is an extreme beer. You know, I'm at 1.079 was what I actually came out with after you considered the original gravity after the mash and the boil. And then once you added what would amount to be about 2 pounds of sugar to that beer, it was about 10.79. So that's not extreme crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that was the idea of adding the sugar in this way, and that's why people do it, is to get a drier beer. But the single edition beer ended up 1.004, and the staggered was 1.005, which is negligible. I mean, that's pretty much the same.
Right.
Yeah. But I was surprised it wasn't drier or
huh, interesting.
Yeah.
So are there any other, before we get into the sensory data, is there any other any other data that you want to share that you measured?
Well, I did track the pH. I don't want to spout out numbers over the podcast because I don't want to put people to sleep any more than we are. But
you don't know my audience. We love numbers.
No, the pH and the gravities matched what you would see on activity. So, you know, essentially I had a very large pH drop in the first 28 hours with the single edition, and I did have a less aggressive drop in the staggered. And the same thing with the gravities. I told you that the single edition went from essentially, 1.079 to about 6.0 in 24 hours. And then another 24 hours, that beer was down to like, I think it was 1.050. And the staggered edition was a more gradual drop along the way, less of a step change. Mm. And the pH matched. And they ended up essentially at the same pH. They ended up at the same gravity.
So the numbers would say that it doesn't make a difference.
The numbers would, right.
But what do the palates say? That's the question.
All right.
So you sent us three samples.
That's right.
And before we even opened the Google survey, we didn't even know what the experiment was going to be about. So we were to do a triangle test with a red sample, a green sample, and a blue sample. And we compared the three, and it was after the first step, after we chose which one we thought was different, then we were led into the reason behind the experiment.
Does that make you nervous when I do that?
We're always nervous.
One of these days I'm going to do a ghost pepper beer experiment, not even tell you.
Well, Steve and I are wanting you to do something like that, where one sample has ghost pepper and the other two don't. We want something we can be assured that we can get it right.
Which one did I brew while listening to heavy metal?
Just as long as, it's not rat poison or something like that. So anyway, we had a sampling here at the studio, and Steve brought a special guest, and here's how it went. Well, Steve Wilkes, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks, James. It's a pleasure to be here.
And today you've brought a very special guest.
I did. My good friend Scott Bolton from St. Louis, good beer enthusiast, but not a brewer.
Do they brew beer in St. Louis?
They do. They still do brew a lot of it. One particular company, but now we've got since they fired all of their brewers, we now have a lot of good craft beers that are starting. So.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, that's another show.
Yeah.
We have taken the test and Scott, this is your first Brewlosophy test, and I guess your first you are a casual beer drinker, right? Or how did you evaluate this test? Was it easy or hard?
I thought it was very difficult. Very subtle differences. I mean, I drink a lot of beer, and I almost always drink craft beer. So, and I thought it was all very good, but trying to tell the differences was difficult.
Steve,
same. I had a mouthful of beer, which is not uncommon. So
I was going to say, a stretch. It's a long show. We got to fill up most of an hour.
Try the veal. I'll be here all week.
Tip your waiter.
Tip your waiter. It's the best in the city. The I thought the test was really hard too. The differences are very subtle. I have a feeling, I have a inkling that maybe I got this one right. Of course, I'm going to probably get it wrong, but once I read through the survey and took it, I went, oh, this makes some sense now to my palate. So we'll see.
Okay. So, Scott, which one did you pick as the odd one out?
The green.
The green. Okay. And we were asked to, after the initial choice, we were told to compare the red and the blue together.
Correct.
So my logic would say that it's not the green.
Right. Well, I thought I was asked to compare the green and the green and the red, and I was asked to not do the blue.
These guys
Holy
are tricky
hats. Okay. Are you kidding me? You got a different.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Shut my mouth.
Doggone, I'm less confident.
Me too.
So, which one did you pick?
I picked the red one. That's the odd duck.
I did too.
Okay.
Oh no! Wait. No, I picked the blue one. I picked the blue one as the odd duck, and it told me to compare the red and the blue.
And that's what it told me to do, too.
Even though you...
So we each picked a different one.
Wow.
Okay.
That's okay.
Okay, I'm even less confident.
Yeah, I know, me too. But so then it asked about the staggered sugar additions.
Right.
Well, I stagger around sugar all the time. So I feel confident.
By the time it's time to add the sugar in the fermenter,
I'm staggering.
You're staggering anyway.
Staggering all over the place. I thought that the blue one tasted like it would have had the sugar additions. It actually tasted more sugary. Somehow to me. So it had that kind of, when I drink it, and I think these are Belgian beers. Would you guys agree with that?
They're very Belgian-y.
I was almost like, oh, I'm afraid to even say that, but they're very Belgian-y, and the blue one to me just had that big kind of hot, almost sugar pop. There was kind of a, well, I've just had beers, other beers in my lifetime that it reminded me of, and then I found out that they were heavily dosed with a lot of sugar.
Huh.
So I don't know.
Well, one would assume that it's the same amount of sugar. It's just the
when
it was added into the.
I agree. I don't know why, but that just. But as soon as I read the word sugar, kind of the whole survey fell into place for me.
But now you're not a brewer, Scott.
Not a brewer.
But what are your impressions?
Well, why I chose the green was because it seemed to. I feel for how it hits my palate and my tongue. And it just seemed like these two were more in the back of my tongue and back of my mouth. And this had both, had a little right at the tip. And so that's how I usually kind of judge beers more of how they hit my taste buds, basically.
Did you have a feeling on which was sweeter and which was drier, if I can put words in your
mouth? Yeah, no, yeah. I would say this was not as sweet as the other two.
The green.
Yeah, it was less sweet.
My feeling, the red and the Brewlosophy folks have sent us color-coordinated cups this time, as well as...
It's a nice touch.
We have red, green, and blue. We have RGB cups.
Yes. If there had been four beers, it would have been CMYK.
But the first one I tasted was the red. And my feeling, my thought on that was, ooh, that is sweet. Mm-hmm. I thought that is a lot of sugar. That is that to me was too sweet, a bit too sweet.
Yeah.
So and then I thought the green was similar, and I thought the blue was a bit drier. But as I tasted along, the difference in my palate narrowed. Right. You know, so it was very difficult to check. It wasn't like wow, this is way sweeter than the others. But I did feel that the blue was a bit drier than the other two. Just a little bit. And my assumption is that the blue is the staggered sugar additions. And therefore, the yeast was better able to digest or to ferment those sugars in a staggered addition rather than all at once. You know what I'm saying? Is that that's my logic.
Right.
And I don't know that that's backed up by any kind of science whatsoever. But that's my feeling.
I agree with your feeling. But I
you validated.
But I do validate your belief system. Though I don't necessarily support it.
That's all I ask.
And I will stand with you in a parade if need be. I agreed with everything you said, except I thought the opposite of the sweetness.
Oh.
So I completely agree with what you said, but the palate conclusion was...
Interesting.
That was different.
So we all think that we all agree, but we all think the different beer is less sweet.
Yeah.
So if the whole survey was us, there would be no statistical.
Well, we kind of call that a circle sometimes.
now it's a family show. Yeah.
Well, I meant that in a Steve Martin sort of way.
Referring to the movie.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Which I have on DVD. I'm picking out a thermos for you. So did we like the beers?
Yes, I like Belgian beers. I do would agree with both what you said earlier is they're, for my taste, they're a little on the sweet side. I mean, you know, I would like a drier beer. And even the one I thought was dry, I thought it was still pretty sweet.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And at first when I was doing the taste test, I was kind of looking for hops. I don't know why, but I came into the test looking for hop differences. And so you kind of first have to narrow down what it is you're looking for in a way.
Right.
Yeah, I thought when I first tasted the red, I thought Pez. It was that kind of sweet, fruity kind of taste to me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I don't know what that means.
Well, when I smelled both all three before I drank them, these two smelled malty to me, and this one did not.
The red and the blue smelled malty, and the green did not.
I could actually pick up the malt smell.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
So I think, well, it's it was fun. One of us is right.
Right. Yeah, right. That's a nice thing. We can sleep easy at night.
And we'll wait until the show posts here in a few days to know who's who. And we're tied, Steve. I think we're tied.
Yeah, I believe so. Well, this was interesting. Yeah, and good. They're good beers. They are a little sweet for me, but I'm sure that was the point. Was to.
Yeah, they could have loaded them up with sugar just to accentuate the results.
Right. No, so. but quite tasty.
All right. Well, thank you, Scott, for joining in for your first Brewlosophy experiment, your first appearance on Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you, James. Right if you get work.
Hang by your thumbs. So if we are to use our data as all the data, we were evenly split. And so, you know, according to us, it doesn't make a difference. We couldn't pick out the odd sample out. So were we, first of all, I guess we should find out who was right, because each one of us picked a different one. So one of us is right.
So what's your confidence level, James?
Not very confident.
Yeah. No. Were any of the three of you felt like you nailed it?
No.
Okay. Well, you seem to be a nice guy, and I think it was really nice of you to allow the guest to be correct on this one.
Oh,
Scott.
Oh, my goodness.
Scott picked green, and Scott was correct.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and the good news is that Steve and I are still tied.
I knew that was coming. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Scott is going to be thrilled. How awesome is that?
Yeah. Yeah, that goes to show you don't need to be an expert per se or have a lot of experience to be able to tell the difference between two beers.
See, now Steve, it's interesting because Steve was saying that the blue tasted more sugary to him, and I was saying the blue tasted more dry.
Yeah, that was funny to me. I got a laugh out of that.
So Scott was right.
Yeah, and Scott claimed that the green, which he thought was different, was less sweet. Uh-huh. But he also thought that the red and blue were more malty. So he might be, you know, maybe not as adroit at describing things per se, mm-hmm. but he did pick the different beer, and that's the object of the triangle test.
So which was which?
The green was the staggered edition.
Huh. Interesting.
Yes.
Huh. Well, it was very, very close, as all these are. And you guys, as I say, please send us something that's more different so we can, you know, mm-hmm. we can pick this out. So, okay. So we got one out of three in our little group. And I'm thrilled for Scott. That's awesome. So how did the rest of – how many more people did you have sample this, and how did everybody else do?
So other than you three, we had 34 others for a total of 37 people.
Wow.
Which means that we would have needed 18 to correctly identify the unique sample for a P less than 0.05, which is our standard for significance. But we only had 16 tasters, which is a P of 0.10. So that is not a significant finding.
Hmm. So was it evenly – so 16 picked the right one, and was it evenly distributed among the other two? You know, in other words, did equal numbers pick each sample?
It's usually pretty close, you know, within one or two. So the other, you know, the balance of the other people, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's usually within one or two. We hardly ever see a large correlation for, let's just say in this case, it would be blue and red, you know. So that's usually pretty good, because if it's real tilted, we have to wonder about how we served it and stuff like that.
Okay, so we got the hard numbers as far as who got it right. But did you read anything into the feedback that you gathered from the participants?
Well, there's one thing that we do track regardless of significance, and that is preference. And that's because we'll take that data from the people who were correct, and we'll ask them about their preference. And that was pretty evenly split, with 9 saying they preferred the staggered beer, which is the one that's green that Scott picked, and you didn't. I just thought I'd mention that again.
Steve didn't either.
And so that's 53% preferred the staggered beer. And then 7 or 47% preferred the single dose beer. Hmm. So, and then the rest of the stuff, we like to make sure we mention that, because it's insignificant, that these impressions may not have any bearing. You know, that's like the disclaimers at the end of medical, you know, commercials and stuff like that, you know, because basically we're showing that people can't reliably, you know, differentiate. So then to go bloviate about why they're different, it's puppycock, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So potentially, I mean, it's just, we have to make sure that we say that. Otherwise, it sounds like you're hanging your hat on insignificant data, right?
If you get the numbers right in the lottery, you can't say that it's because it was your son's birthday that you picked on the numbers.
But I do interview people and talk to people. That's part of the fun of doing the panels. And, you know, some people were in line. You know, I usually talk to the people who are correct, you know, and if I can. And we'll just say the people that were right tended to think that the staggered beer was slightly less alcoholic in flavor, and the staggered beer had slightly lower esters. Now, because of my, you know, under pitching, I do think I coaxed more esters out than I really wanted to, and it gave the impression of sweetness. And I concur with that. You know, I was a little upset when I first tasted it. I mean, I like the beer. I definitely like the beer, but I think that, and I've had this happen before with triples and golden strongs and doubles and such. The beer is dry, right? We measured it. It's 1.004 and 1.005, but it can still be perceived as sweet,
mm-hmm.
Because of the, you know, ester production and alcohol. Alcohol can provide a sweetness and a slickness as well. People think of it always as purely drying, but it's not always the case.
So did Steve and I, since we didn't pick the right one, did we get it right, or did we mess up on the survey?
No. That's a good point.
Where afterwards we didn't pick the right one, so we were asked to compare the two that were the same. In other words, screw that up?
No, what it does is it'll ask you to compare two beers that are the same, because your data, your preference, and any other questions that we tag on is discounted. In that you weren't able to tell the two beers or the three beers apart, so you weren't able to tell the different beer. So then to go on and ask you your preference, it's less desired. It still shoots you off like into a little pipeline, and we still track it. But really, when we report in the articles, what we do is we report on the 16 people in this case who were correct in identifying the beer.
So in other words, in the beginning when we used to take these things, if you got it wrong, you basically – the quiz stopped.
Yeah. So
but now we're sent off into this la-la land where we think we're doing work, but we're actually
– So one of the problems is, like, say I usually only have 3 or 4 people going at once. But, you know, say there's 2 or 3 people tasting, and one person is like – keeps touching and fidgeting with his blue cup, and then he's comparing blue and green. And then he walks away real quick, and we have a lot of repeat, you know, panelists. They get privy to it. And even if you don't want to game the system, sometimes people do inadvertently, because mm-hmm. you want to be right. You know, people want to be right, and some people think that you're actually helping. Like, oh, you know, we want to prove that this is significant. No, sometimes you want to prove that it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Actually, we don't really want to prove anything. We want to see,
right?
You know, which way it goes.
Right.
You know,
so the bottom line with this experiment, with this one beer, with this one series of tasting, it doesn't appear to make a significant difference whether you throw in all the sugar at the beginning of the fermentation or stagger it throughout the fermentation.
Right. Yeah. So for this beer, for this recipe, for this yeast, yada, 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 you know, at this gravity. So you know, one of the things we touched on in the article, which you can go to at brewlosophy.com, is you can go to the bottom of the article and, you know, we close out with, hey, this leads to more questions, right? Maybe we need to try this at 1.090 or 1.1 gravity. Maybe there's a point at which it starts to diverge and it matters more. This isn't an extreme beer, you know, per se at somewhere around 1080. Mm-hmm. So, or maybe the percentage of sugar matters more, you know, so because my sugar was about 14% of the recipe, that's diluting, you know, nutrients and free amino acids and everything else. So maybe at 20%, maybe at 25%, it matters. That's something else to look into.
So this thing, you know, the rookie got it right. this leads me to somebody posted on our Basic Brewing Facebook page, a link to an article on brewlosophy.com talking about the controversy on whether quote-unquote untrained tasters were any better or worse at figuring these things out than people who had, let's say, BJCP training. So do you want to talk about that? I mean, here we have a rookie that came up with the right answer. And, you know, we guys who have been, you know, tasting homebrew and craft beer all over the place for the past decade, we got it wrong. So why can't we smarter guys figure it out?
Well, the analogy I used with someone else was, just because you go to basketball camp doesn't mean you get taller. So you are, you know, you can't coach height, you know. So you are given, for whatever reason, a certain palate and an ability to detect certain things, and people's ranges and thresholds are all over the place. And that's what you're given. So training, you may be able to become a little more acute and recognize some things that you maybe previously had glossed over, but you can only taste what you can taste. And humans are very good at determining differences, you know, A versus B, but that can cause, you know, a lot of false positives because it's one versus the other. That's why they use the triangle. Well, it just seems to be that it doesn't matter if you've been trained other than being able to pick out differences. So training might be able to tell you, oh, that buttery taste is diacetyl. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make you be able to all of a sudden go a few ppm lower, you know, or actually it's probably tenths of a ppm lower for diacetyl. But you're either given a certain ability to taste diacetyl or you're not. So even if you're a rookie, you don't know why it's different. You just know that it is.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, what you're measuring is the performance in the triangle test of trying to pick out the odd one out. You're not saying that the rookies are any better or worse at identifying certain flavor profiles or flaws in the beer or X, Y, and Z. This is just which one is different. And according to your data, the more trained people weren't any better at picking out the odd one out than the untrained, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was almost a wash. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was within a couple percentage points, so it doesn't really matter in my opinion. And one of the things, you know, we like to mention is that, okay, so Scott got it, you know, right in this instance. He picked green. Now, if you were to go ask Scott, how would you get rid of that flavor? You know, oh, how would you correct the ester sweetness? How would you correct, you know, the fact that it's slightly alcoholic? You know, he may have less of ability to do that than you or Steve.
Right, right. You know? And if you asked him to quantify the difference, he might not know how to put it in words because perhaps he doesn't know. It doesn't have the vocabulary, or he doesn't know, you know, what a buttery beer is, or what, you know, what a skunky beer is, or what, you know, all these things that we've been sort of trained by either formal training or experience over the years to identify. He doesn't have that vocabulary yet.
Right. And another thing I've noticed, because I'll have my wife try a beer occasionally, and she doesn't come into it with a bias. A rookie might not come into it with a bias. So, you know, say Steve and you were having this beer. And you said, oh, this is probably a triple or a Belgian Golden Strong. And you start almost searching for things that should be there or shouldn't be there. Whereas a lesser trained taster, especially for a triangle, isn't doing that. They're just going, this one's different. And they don't care why. It's just different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas someone who has a lot of beer knowledge can sometimes, if they don't have the ability to block some of that out, you know, don't look for hops. I think Steve mentioned he was looking for hops. Why?
Yeah.
You know?
It's true. Yeah. And we were given paper cups where you couldn't see the beer.
Right.
So, you know, that's a way of kind of forcing us to put on blinders. Whereas if we were looking at these in clear cups or clear glasses, you know, we might have been trying to look for a difference there. We have to open our minds and just go with the flow and try to sense what we can sense.
Yeah, and recently Marshall put out a call for help. You know, especially because some of those guys live in less populated areas. So basically, if you are in an area, you can go to the brewlosophy.com, go to the contributors, and it tells where we reside. If you're near one of these contributors, you can email them through the Brewlosophy page, and it's basically saying, come help us taste. You know, and because of that article, hopefully people will have the confidence to do so. They don't sit there and say, well, I'm not some grandmaster judge or a cicerone. You don't need to be, and we've shown that it doesn't necessarily matter.
Yeah, and come and taste and bring a friend. Like
bring
Steve
a friend,
did.
Yeah, exactly. That was awesome. I was really happy to hear that.
Yeah, well, I'm happy happy that he came as well, because number one, I met a nice guy, and we spent some time that evening. Steve cooked us up a dinner, which was awesome. So not only did we have a good time, we got to find out that he was better on that day than we were. So kudos to Scott.
Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks for contributing. Hopefully he hears this. And as always, thank you, James, and thank you, Steve Wilkes.
I was going to say, as for us, thanks for nothing.
No, absolutely not. I got to stress that there is no right answer. You know, I think in the early on, sometimes you're kind of rooting for something. In one of our articles we recently wrote about how we think about insignificant experiment results. And, you know, I admitted that in early on, especially with water chemistry, something I put a lot of time into, I'm almost like, oh, please matter. please matter all this time I've spent, you know, reading about this. And regardless, I like it and enjoy it. But imagine, you know, some people treat it like a religion. They're almost believing in it. And then all of a sudden it doesn't matter. Our seems to not matter, because we like to stress that, you know, one experiment is not the end of the conversation on any particular variable. But, you know, you're almost like, oh, come on, water chemistry, you know. So now, you know, I've really stepped back, and I think most of us have, and just said, hey, regardless of what the result is, I learn.
Right.
Right. So stop treating it like you're rooting for a variable, and start rooting for knowledge instead, you know, the opportunity to learn.
And this isn't the limit on this, because the way science works is you repeat experiments, and it's repeatability that tells you if you've really got a result. I mean, there could have been some kind of fluke in this experiment where the result didn't show as well as it would on another day under different circumstances.
Absolutely. I could do the same exact recipe, everything the same, and I might get a different – I mean, I'm not brewing in a controlled lab like you see on Dr. Charlie Bamforth's, you know, videos. If you go on YouTube and check him out, they have a very controlled system. You know, this is homebrewers doing homebrewer experiments for homebrewers.
Now, one thing we didn't address is temperature. What temperature were these fermented at?
I had really cold groundwater that day here in western Pennsylvania, so my beer got down to 62. I put them in the fermentation chamber at 64. Pitched then, and I suppressed the free rise. I didn't want it to just go rocketing up, because especially with all that sugar. So I capped it at 68, and then when it got there, about 36 hours later, I started ramping it up.
Hmm.
You know, so I just slowly walking it up, and it got all the way up to about 79 degrees, 80 degrees, somewhere around there.
So there's another variable that you can test.
Absolutely.
I mean, and you know, along with higher gravity, different kinds of sugar, different kinds of yeast, different temperatures as well. So this is just the beginning in talking about this this technique. So it's not the end of the conversation. It's,
no.
It's the beginning.
No, and I would encourage other home brewers to try it, you know, even if not with some fancy Google Forms survey, you know, just with your friends and just write in, call in to you or write in to us at brewlosophy.com and share your results. And this is supposed to spark conversations.
Right. Awesome. Well, I look forward. I understand from Marshall that there's another experiment in the works that you guys are going to share with us, and so I look forward to that. But Malcolm, it's been a pleasure, and thank you very, very much for sharing the experiment. And I look forward to you guys testing brewing conventions and and stirring up the waters and the wort.
Yeah. Hey, it's a lot of fun talking to you as always, James. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers, Malcolm.
Cheers.
Well, thanks again to Malcolm and to Steve and the big winner this week, Scott. Scott has the opportunity to retire undefeated at this point, of course, while Steve and I are still tied. I don't know what the exact score is. I just know that we've each gotten the right answer and failed an equal amount of times. You can check out more details about this experiment and even join a conversation about it in the comments at brewlosophy.com, brewlosophy.com. And thanks again to everybody involved in the process. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. You can get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. And you can find our logbooks, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country. You sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Quicksilver Snowmen's Brigade Beanie, Bossa Nova. Turns out Bossa Nova is a color. Bossa Nova. And Hugger Mugger D-Ring Yoga Strap, 8 foot. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who but what. So no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Bossa Nova Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dudson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.